Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Coming up on today's program, Taiwan imposes sanctions on Philippines over the killing of a fisherman from the Filipino Coast Guard. Big retailers agree on new standards for factories in Bangladesh, and Australia puts more money aside for processing asylum seekers. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Taiwan has imposed sanctions on the Philippines, rejecting as unacceptable an apology from Manila over the killing of a fisherman from Taiwan last week. The row is the latest flare-up in tensions in the area, where several countries are engaged in territorial disputes in the potentially resourceful rich region. Earlier, Taiwan recalled its envoy from the Philippines, and the Filipino envoy has returned to the country. The sanctions include the freezing of migrant worker applications to Taiwan and the halt of economic and military exchanges. Liam Cochran speaks next to Denny Roy, who's a Taiwan affairs specialist at the East-West Center in Hawaii.
There's a total of 11 measures that have been mentioned, specific things that Taiwan will do to put pressure on the Philippines. There was an initial wave of three, and now eight more announced, with Taiwan leaving the door open to more to come. The most serious of these is, as you mentioned on the program earlier, the freeze on the processing of Filipino workers who've applied to work in Taiwan, because Taiwan is one of those places that are very important to produce income for Filipino workers to send back home, and comprises a major part of the total earnings of the Philippines.
It's a very strong reaction from Taipei. What's going on in the background here? Why have they reacted so strongly?
Well, first of all, this issue over the apology is kind of an interesting one. I think, as you mentioned, the Philippines government seems to be trying pretty hard and seemingly pretty sincerely to register an apology, to register regret, but it's not being accepted by Taiwan. I wonder if there may be some cultural difference here. There's different expectations as to what particularly should be said by whom. But the deeper background involves, first of all, on the part of the Philippines, there's resentment in the Philippines that the Taiwan fishing industry is just so much stronger, has a better infrastructure and longer reach than the Philippine fishing industry. They feel like they're at a disadvantage in this competition over disputed waters of who gets to fish. On the Taiwan side, the people of Taiwan have endured several cases of what they feel like have been unfair hassling and even harming of their fishermen and fishing boats on the part of the Philippines, and they furthermore feel that they're disadvantaged because they're Taiwan and not China, and therefore they're afraid that the Philippines feels more at liberty to take a shot at Taiwan as opposed to China in an incident like this.
And I should just clarify in the introduction, I think I may have misspoken, but just to be clear about it, the Philippines officially recognizes mainland China, Beijing, for official diplomatic contact, and that is why the Manila Economic and Cultural Office takes care of relations with Taiwan.
It's a quasi-embassy. Yeah.
Exactly, yes. So that obviously does complicate the situation, as do the other maritime disputes happening in the South China Sea. Obviously, the Philippines are a player in that, Taiwan as well. How much of this is sort of reputation building and protecting as far as who's going to maintain a tough line in the South China Sea disputes?
Well, you can easily imagine this is an example of Philippines sort of taking out their frustrations with China on Taiwan, which is in a much weaker position both diplomatically and in terms of the force that they can put into the area, even though Taiwan is also a claimant in the South China Sea. One can imagine what kind of ramifications might occur if something like this was to happen in the South China Sea with say, China at the other end, with the greater possibility that now and in the future, China is more likely to have force actually in place in the area and would be able to respond immediately or shortly with government-armed vessel.
Certainly. And have any other regional players got involved in this dispute?
Up to now, the others are looking on with concern. The Attention turns, first of all, of course, to China and the United States. China's reaction is seeing this as an opportunity to show solidarity with Taiwan, to reiterate the Chinese position that China and Taiwan are compatriots, and therefore China's been piling on by demanding that the Philippines further explain the situation and punish the murderer, as they put it. The U.S. reaction from the U.S. State Department official spokesperson has been to express concern and to call on both sides not to escalate and to clarify the causes of this incident and put into place protections against it happening in the future.
The spar of factory disasters in Bangladesh has led to a number of leading European clothing retailers agreeing on improving safety standards for workers in the country. It follows the Rana Plaza tragedy in Dakar last month, in which more than 1,000 garment workers were killed. The agreement guarantees minimal building and fire safety standards and aims to compel retailers to pay for rigorous and independent public inspections and blacklist factories unwilling to comply. But while some big names have signed on, others, including U.S. retailer Walmart and Topshop, haven't. Tracy Hutchinson speaks to Gilbert Hargbo, the Deputy Director of the Field Operations and Partnerships for the International Labour Organization.
Clearly, we are all the parties are working to make sure that the safety issue is being dealt with. And the fact that some of them have not signed off does not take away the hope that we have that there will be a change. I'm sure that though the deadline is today, May 15, I will hope that the discussion will be on between the international union and those retailers. So one should not stop because they have not yet signed.
Indeed. So just explain then, if you would, the significance of what has been achieved and what that means for those workers.
Now, essentially, what the agreement is calling for is an overall security issue, starting with the inspection, naming an inspector general that will be in charge and making sure that we have credible inspection of all the 3,500 plus manufacturers, and then dealing with the remedial actions and if they may have technical issues. But the accord is some kind of agreement in general principles. One, they're giving themselves 45 days to work on the details on how that will be implemented. And they call on ILO support, which ILO will be ready within our mandate.
The Bangladeshi government has indicated it will legislate to improve conditions for garment factory workers. Exactly how is still to be known fully. But in the ILO's view, what more needs to be done?
I mean, in terms of the worker, the legislation, the labor law has to be improved to guarantee the workers. Right to freedom of association and collective bargaining. So this is really the central point of where we are working with the government right now. The government has passed that bill through the cabinet and now has to go to the parliament. Meanwhile, the workers' association have clearly indicated that they were very unhappy about the new text. So there have been additional discussions with the help of ILO between the government, the union, and the employers in Dhaka. And so this is also giving a new result. So there will be a new proposal that will go to the law. The very important thing is to make sure that whatever will be approved by the parliament really guarantee the workers' freedom of association and collective bargaining. That will make it a direct link with the security at work because they can be in better position to look at the issues in terms of a working environment.
Yes, you mentioned at the outset, Gilbert Hargbo, that from the ILO's perspective that you want to maintain some optimism and confidence that some of those big name manufacturers would indeed sign on. That said, given that they haven't to this stage signed on, is there confidence that the accord would be adhered or indeed enforced?
No, it's not for us in ILO to call for a given company to sign on or not to sign on. This is really a negotiation between the two parties. But where I'm positive, I'm saying that both parties, be it the retailers, be it the international unions, be it the national stakeholders, though they have not signed up, everybody agrees that something they have to do something. So that's why I'm very hopeful that at the end of the day, something will happen and will start happening soon.
If you could, in a broad sense, then, tell us how willing some of those multinationals have been to discuss some of those issues. If they haven't been prepared to sign on, are they at least at the table talking about it?
I'm sure there are a lot of things that's going on behind the scene. My understanding is that some of them may not feel at ease with some specific provisions of the overall text, but it does not take away the fact that they really want to do something. And some of them have been approaching ILO, be it in Geneva, be it in Dhaka, with a very serious intention that they want to contribute, be it the safety issue, some of them in terms of training the staff in the aftermath, how do that regain their life back. So there is a serious, sincere determination by all parties. I believe one of the reasons why some of them are reluctant to sign is that they may not agree with some provision, and maybe some of them have issue with their lawyers not clearing the way it's set. So we believe that even after the deadline, if the parties continue discussing, and I don't see a reason why they will not continue discussion.
Yes.
One way or the other, there will be some positive outcome.
And in real terms, how will this improve conditions for for those garment workers?
Because we will move immediately in inspecting the facilities and making sure that the remedial actions are taken. This is the concrete immediate actions, and we will also move to improve the workers' rights with the government and with the local employers.
As Australia sets aside more money to pay for processing of asylum seekers, the Australian Federal Police and the Indonesian National Police say they've caught up with a notorious people smuggler. Javed Muhammad Butt, also known as Hussein Bilu, is an alleged people smuggler wanted in connection with an asylum seeker boat which sank last year, with an estimated 90 people on board. Australia's two biggest parliamentary groupings are promising to solve the problem by smashing what they term as people smuggling business model. But the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime believes Australia won't be able to completely stop the boats. James Glenday reports.
Most asylum seekers pay people smugglers between $7,000 and $20,000 to get to Australia, and about 25,000 have arrived in the past year and a half.
It's very big business. I mean, if you would calculate this by an average of $14,000, you'll come up with a quite high amount.
About $350 million, in fact. Sebastian Baumeister from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says people smuggling in the region is a high-profit, low-risk business that's adapted easily to recent changes in government policy.
I don't believe so that you can fully stop maritime boat arrivals coming from Indonesia to Australia. The challenge is to get the organisers, but the organisers are certainly in the countries of origin and transit, and it's very difficult to get hold of them.
He says the people smuggling business model will be very difficult to break, but it's a goal both sides of federal politics are committed to.
If I were a politician in Australia, my main focus would be on managing expectations.
Dr. Khalid Kossa from the Geneva Centre for Security Policy says people smuggling is a diverse business. A number of smugglers are part of organised crime networks. Others set up small family operations, while some are humanitarians who just want to get people to safety.
I think we have to recognise that irregular migration and, in your case, boat arrivals will continue at some number. You might be able to manage the numbers, you might be able to reduce the numbers, but they will continue. And I think politicians should be honest about and admit it.
The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says the resumption of offshore processing last August, the upcoming federal election, and impending withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan may have created a rush which has led to the recent big increases in boat arrivals, but it's difficult to be sure.
There's few topics on which so much is written without knowing anything.
Professor Andreas Schlernhardt from the Migrant Smuggling Working Group at the University of Queensland says government departments need to release much more information about what they're doing to disrupt people smugglers.
We know a lot less about the problem than we did 10, 15 years ago. The sort of big headlines and snazzy slogans that politicians come up are not very helpful in this.
Improving quality of life in source countries such as Afghanistan and Iran is considered the best long-term
long-term way of stopping people smuggling. But in the meantime, Kaz Coleman from the Minister's Council on Asylum Seekers in Detention says Australians have to face up to some difficult decisions.
I think we do need to think seriously about whether we need to accept there will be a higher rate of arrival into Australia. How much can we manage that well? And also, how do we receive them appropriately when they do get here?
Curly questions for whoever wins September's election.
A court in Miramar has charged six Muslim men with the murder of a Buddhist monk, which triggered intercommunal violence in the town of Metete in March. 3 days of rioting followed, in which 43 people died, according to police reports. Human rights groups have criticized the authorities for targeting only Muslims, although President Thein Sein this week issued reassurance that the fundamental rights of Muslims would be upheld. Karen Snowden has more.
The official commission's report into last year's deadly violence in the Rakhine state recommended the doubling of troop numbers to keep the two groups segregated. Tens of thousands of displaced Rohingyas are forced to endure squalid conditions in camps they're not allowed to leave. The NGO Human Rights Watch has criticised the report and claims the authorities were involved in ethnic cleansing in Rakhine. The group's Deputy Director for Asia, Phil Robertson, says the charging of only Muslims over the violence in March in Mektila is another example of the unequal application of the law.
Well, our primary concern is that all parties be held accountable, that persons in the Muslim communities and the Buddhist communities responsible for violence during these incidents are brought to justice, that all are equal before the law.
Now, while there haven't been any charges against Buddhists up to this point, out of the 70 arrested over these particular incidents, some 40 of those were Buddhists. So 40 Buddhists have been arrested, 28 Muslims have been arrested. But what I'm saying is the authorities haven't necessarily turned a blind eye to the Buddhist side.
No, we're not saying that either. I mean, we're saying this as a general aspirational thing, that there has to be a thorough investigation all the way through. We've seen this in Arakan state where impunity to abuse has definitely been present.
In the 3 days of rioting in March following the killing of the Buddhist monk Yu Thorbitter, 43 people died, 86 were injured, and more than 1,300 homes and other buildings destroyed. According to the UN, about 12,000 people, mostly Muslims, who make up 5% of the population, were displaced. Radical monks, complicit security forces, and government inaction have all been blamed for the rise in anti-Muslim violence that threatens to undermine the reform process in Myanmar. Former diplomat, security intelligence analyst, and a 40-year researcher on Myanmar issues, Dr. Andrew Self, says this sort of violence is not new.
There's been anti-Muslim feeling for decades. It's always been beneath the surface and it crops up occasionally to a greater or lesser extent. I see what is happening now as being just another one of those occasions where anti-Muslim feeling has peaked, usually triggered by a specific event, even quite a small event sometimes, and then once it takes off, it spreads very, very quickly until it dampens down again. Religious intolerance has always existed in Burma, not just against the Muslims, but also against Christians and others.
Andrew Self is an adjunct research fellow at the Griffith Asia Institute and is a well-regarded author on Myanmar. He has some concerns about the role of the security forces.
There has been, I think, a troubling degree of, if not complicity in some of these disturbances, lack of action against them by the armed forces and by the police, which suggests that either they are sympathetic to the anti-Muslim mobs or perhaps they are simply not being sufficient direction and guidance from NAPIDOR to tackle them.
Myanmar's handling of the communal violence will continue to arouse intense international scrutiny. The role of the monks in this strongly Buddhist-majority country is also attracting attention. Andrew Self.
At a rough guess, there's about 400,000 monks in Burma, and their views, as far as we know them, range from one end of the spectrum all the way to the other. So when we talk about the monks, I think we need to be a little bit careful not to just sort of brand them as just one homogenous mass. I think that after the armed forces, they are the only national institution, if you like, that spans the entire country with its own internal communications and structure. They therefore have the potential to play a very strong role, but it can be a destructive one, it can be a productive one. My guess is that most monks are fairly supportive of Aung San Suu Kyi and the democratisation movement, and are certainly very supportive of measures that will help the poorer people in the society. But beyond that, it's, well, unknown.
A short Indian film called Sati is bringing awareness to the problem of violence against women in India. It recently won top prize at the Indian Film Festival in Melbourne, Australia. The film portrays the ancient tradition of sacrificing widows. Karen Arnott from Australia Network has more.
Sati is basically burning. Still, women are burning in a different form. I can't imagine a woman is dragged in a fire. It's such a horrifying thing.
It was a shocking and brutal practice, women sacrificing themselves on their husband's funeral pyre. Sometimes they did it willingly, out of respect for their husband. Others were made to do it by force. The practice dates back thousands of years, and the term Sati originates from the goddess Sati, who sacrificed herself by fire because she was unable to bear her father's humiliation of her husband. The practice was banned by the British in 1829, but there are small pockets of India where it still continues. Last year, director Nilesh Desai and his producer and wife Vinita Desai spent 4 days in a Mumbai studio filming their own representation of Sati.
It's about the nightmare of a mother, horrified dream of a mother, being haunted by the fear of the god of death, Yama.
These are some things that we try to portray just for the audience to understand that how deep an impact evils like this can be, you know, it could be your mother, your daughter, or anybody around you.
There's no dialogue in the short film. Instead, it uses powerful music and imagery to portray the suppression of women. And it's the evils of Sati and the evils of violence against women in India in general that the filmmakers want the audience to think about. At the end of the movie, they pose a number of confronting questions.
Still, we are facing the same problem like in India. There was a child abuse, child rape, sexual harassment. The problems are still there. So definitely somewhere down the line, women are still burning.
I think it's very relevant, especially in today's context, when India is going through a bit of an upheaval, especially in the past sort of year, where we have seen sort of absolutely bizarre cases of violence against women happening, and a large civil unrest or a large sort of participation by the common man who has taken to the streets to protest against violence against women.
Drawing on the theme of freedom, Nilesh Desai entered this year's short film competition at the Indian Film Festival of Melbourne and won.
Sati was definitely a film that makes you sit up and take notice. And I think a combination of the fact that the issue that the film was talking about and the way it was presented is what attracted me to the film.
I really want to sensitize the issue, actually. Empowerment is very necessary, you know.
Such is the power of the film that everyone on the set was deeply affected during the filming.
One of the actresses who was actually, trying to go close to the fire came back and she was in tears because she said it was horrifying to go near the fire, and if I could do it as an act, how would it be if I had to do it in reality?
Sati is very relevant because, it is talking about the fact that ultimately, the way we are looking at women in our society, the role that they're playing, that has to change. So there can be rules and laws that can come into effect, but nothing's going to change unless the mindset changes. And that is what, those are the questions that the film provokes.
And with that report from Kate Arnott, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. I want to take a moment now to tell you about another edition of the program you can hear May 19th. That's because from May 19th until June 9th, PCJ Radio International will be conducting tests to East and Southeast Asia from 13 to 14 hours UTC. These dates are on Sundays. The frequency is 11750 kilohertz. That's 11750 kilohertz in the 25-meter band. And that's going to be targeting East and Southeast Asia. The first 15 minutes of that one-hour transmission will be a short version of Focus Asia Pacific that'll be presented by Andy Sennett. You can find all the information on these transmissions at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, our email is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end today with playback Bollywood singer Mohammed Rafi with a song from 1966 called, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Baharon Pul Barasau. Well, that's the best I can do. Until next time, friends, so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye.
Baharo phool barsao, mera mehboob aaya hai, mera mehboob aaya hai. Baharo phool barsao, mera mehboob aaya hai, mera mehboob aaya hai. Hawa o ragni gaao, mera mehboob aaya hai, mera mehboob aaya hai. लगा इन गोरे हाथों में उतर आ ए घटा काजल लगा इन प्यारी आंखों में सितारों मांग भर जाओ मेरा महबूब आया है मेरा महबूब आया है बहारों फूल बरसाओ मेरा महबूब